this week on The Inside Flap.
And then you use this thing that looks like a dentist pick to push the pins up. The pincer would hold the lock. And I thought, okay, 10 seconds for the lockpick, 10 minutes for me, 2.5 hours later. and some language that I would not be appropriate for our conversation.
Yeah.
And I put it down to the fact that I was distracted by my dogs who were staring at me, thinking, what's he up to?
Like, grab some of his pins, lay out the pants, lay out the light strands, so boom, 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 pin, 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 boom, 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 pin, pin, pin. Grab the pants. I'm like, put me on the tote board. I got one. And Mark starts laughing because he knows me. These other parents.
The tote board.
These other parents are like That's looking funny. At me like, who's this guy? I high step it. And meanwhile, nobody else has moved. They're still hunched up. I high step it. Wait,
did you tuck the battery pack into the pocket?
Yeah, of course. Okay. I don't mess around.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably on the couch. Well, actually, not hunched over. He's fending off the bulldog with his left foot. Clutched in his left hand is the remnants of the largest ice cream sundae I've ever seen, which, by the way, he described as a small sundae, is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Excelsior.
Andy's frozen custard.
Yeah, and so everybody knows ice cream is my comfort food. Mm-hmm. And
right,
yeah,
everybody knows, you know, that. Yes.
There's bananas in here. There's nuts in here. There's cherries in here. I mean, it's dairy. Dairy in here.
It's
healthy.
Yeah.
So healthy. Yeah. So
got
good
some protein.
For you.
That's fruit, right. Fruit.
Welcome to the show. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. I have a great guest for you this week as we're joined by international number one best-selling author Jeffrey Deaver, author of the Lincoln Rhyme series, among others. He's got a new Lincoln Rhyme novel out right now. It's called The Midnight Lock, which I loved, and we'll have that conversation for you in just a bit. He's a great guy to talk to. Always a pleasure talking with Jeffrey Deaver. We chatted a little bit about hotel minibars, talked about his book tour, his trip to Italy, food, good stuff. So we'll have that conversation for you in just a second. Also, we've got our book recommendations.
Book reviews.
And, of course, the ever-popular audiobook of the week. But first, some stories from the week for you guys now. Listen, you've heard, everybody out there, you've heard me get on this microphone and rant and rave about being suckered into helping out with Sylvia's, you know, high school marching band. I spent many a dark night in the Littleton High School parking lot with nothing but an electric saw, a power drill, alongside fellow band parent Chris. And, you know, did nothing but Chris's portable mini work light to guide us through our projects. Andrew, I don't know. Now, you've done a lot of home projects. Like, we had this little work light, and it seemed to me had no good except for the glare in our eyes the whole time we were working with it. Have you had a lot of success with using a work light?
So I wouldn't say success, but when I've done a lot of projects, I've had problems with the work light, but they've got, like, those halogen work lights. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, like, the bulbs are always burning out. And then when you go to replace them, it's like you can't touch the bulb. Otherwise, the oil from your fingers and stuff like that.
No, then that is the problem. The bulb will explode on you. I don't know. It just seemed like no matter where we put it, every time we got to work, it was just glaring in our eyes. You couldn't find a good place to put it. But anyway, a lot of that was back in August and early September, and then I got busy with building sets for my own school. And I know Chris kept at it, and I believe he got a lot of help from fellow band parent Mark. Another band parent. So I kind of dropped off and stopped helping
to
out.
To the point where the woman who runs, like Rhonda, who runs all the, I don't know, what does she do? Like all the sets and props?
Yeah.
She didn't know who you were.
That's right. Yeah. Even though it was all me at the beginning.
But Chris, I was with Chris.
Well, with me, Chris and I. But we were there late at night, so she never saw us.
No. Uh-uh.
I would come directly from work, spend 3 or 4 hours. But yeah, that and that.
Because she asked
that
me.
It did really annoy me. No, that listen, all the hours I put listen, in and she had no idea who
on,
I was.
Yeah. So I'm at the like meet and greet, like drinks, like with the band parents after, like we'd done everything.
Uh-huh.
And Rhonda's like, so Laura, does your husband ever come to
oh my God, come on! Are you kidding me?
No.
Oh.
No. I felt
I need
I
to introduce myself and show her around and show her that some of the things that that I built along with the help of Chris and others. But anyway, so we got the hot Facebook message the week before, or I guess the week of, the big parade down in Meth Head Springs. I mean, Colorado Springs, the big Christmas, you know, parade of lights.
Wow.
Well, I mean.
You did not see that coming.
You've been down
there. Did you, Andrew?
No, but I can't say that I disagree.
I'm not disagreeing either.
No,
I just
disagree. All right, listen, it's a beautiful place. Some questionable characters lurk about down there.
My sister tried to drive Uber in Colorado Springs.
Did she?
And let's just say it didn't work out too well.
No, I can't imagine a worse place to drive an Uber.
Poor Joanne.
So anyway, we got that hot text. They need help with the uniforms. I said, you know what? I'm done working at my school. I can gladly go in on a weeknight and help out a little bit. So I stroll into the band room, and I really felt... Personally, I felt like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. You know, it was
just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
You know, so I stroll in there and I see, you know, 10 parents industriously working. They're hunkered over some tables and I see uniforms.
Hunched.
Yeah, I see tinsel and light strands. I see band pants lying around. And I take it all in. I kind of walk up and I'm like, and I guess I'm like 10 minutes late or whatever. I'm like, you guys need some help. And now the problem is when you got a lot of people around who really don't know too much about what they're doing. And one person who's in charge, who doesn't like to be in charge, who really doesn't know how to tell other people what to do. And I would just kind of stand in there. I get a lot of grunts and, pinning the lights. So yeah, I need help, need help. So I'm just like standing there and
really?
I literally stand there awkwardly for like 30 seconds. I'm like, all right, because I'm getting no direction. I'm getting no direction whatsoever.
I had the opposite experience on Saturday when I volunteered.
Well, this is not the experience I got on Tuesday night. So then I go over to the uniform closet and there I see some people. I'm like, yeah, can I help? Uniforms. Okay, lights. I'm like, all right. So I go back into the band room, and finally I see Mark, who you know, who we know, good guy. And I go over to Mark. I'm like, Mark, what the hell?
What
are we
was
doing
he doing?
Well, he was hunched over his own, and he had cobbled
together. I had a problem
together.
With the hunching; it hurts your back.
He didn't have a table because all the other parents were at the table, so he pulled together two music stands and kind of cobbled together a nice workplace for him. So he explained to me what we were doing, since I guess nobody else was physically. Well, I guess they didn't know me. So he showed me, you go grab a pant out of a uniform bag in the closet, you lay it out, you grab a light strand, you make sure there's batteries in there, and you pin it in, you take some safety pins, and you pin it along the outer seam, this tinsel wrapped around a light strand. I said, great. How many pins? He's like, 4. I said, perfect.
Oh, you guys did 4.
Yes, 4.
I had like 27 4. On my
Well,
way.
Exactly. And I'll get to that in a second. So I'm all business. I go back into the uniform room and I see, now there's over 100 uniforms that we've got to get through. And I'm looking at some of these parents. The pins are not flying around. You know, they're not necessarily hustling. I'm like, all right, well, this has got to change. So I quickly rip open one of the uniform bags, the next one in line. I grab the pants, hustle it into the band room, and I immediately start talking smack to Mark. I'm like, Mark, what pant number are you on? I guess my third one. I grab some of his pins off of his. He had the nice big safety pins.
Oh, really?
So I grab some of his pins, lay out the pants, lay out the light strands. So boom, 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 pin. Boom, 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 pin. Grab the pants. I'm like, put me on the tote board. I got one. And Mark starts laughing because he knows me. These other parents.
The tote board.
These other parents are like looking at me like, who's this guy? I high step it. And meanwhile, nobody else has moved. They're still hunched. I high step it. Wait, back.
Did you tuck the battery pack into the pocket?
Yeah, of course. Okay. I don't mess around. Right. I high step it right back in the uniform closet, chuck the uniform into the bag, grab the next pant, and I'm out and about. I'm going. I'm moving, baby. That's what you got to do. You got over. And these parents, I stopped. And on my way back, I overhear one mom telling another, because I guess she has no problem telling some people how to do it. She goes, yeah, you wanna take up every two light bulbs. We're talking like a strand of lights, like on a Christmas tree. Oh. Every two light bulbs, put a pin. I'm like, what the? We'll be in here till next Thursday if that's how many pins you're putting on. Wow. You don't need. They're just walking down the street for a mile. You don't need 27 pins going down.
So I had to share a pant with another parent.
The hell?
So he had the left side, I had the right side, or whatever side. Each had a side.
No, I'm not sharing with nobody.
But he did tell me one funny thing. Because he was there Wednesday night, or they had to have three nights of this.
Yeah, three nights
so
of it.
So we had...
Because nobody knows how to do it.
We had what's called quilting safety pins, and they're bent. Mm-hmm. So the quilting pins are bent to allow for like thicker fabric to get through.
Right.
And he said he spent half... maybe more of the first night.
Unbending the bent pin?
Throwing the quilting pins out because he thought they were broken.
Oh, no.
And digging through
straight
safety pins.
And that's the problem. That's when you get a bunch of people in there who don't want to tell other people what to do. Nobody can take charge. You got a bunch of leaders or a bunch of followers and no leaders.
I had someone, as soon as I stepped through the door, tell me immediately what to do.
No, I got
to the point
that.
Where I didn't. I still had my coat on. I had my cup of coffee.
Really?
I had my purse and I wanted to like set stuff down and get situated, see the lay of the land. But I didn't have time for that, which is fine. I didn't mind.
Annoys me is I'm there asking for help. I'm like, hey, I'm here to help. What can I do? And I got to say, uniform. Just tell me what to do. I'm here to help.
So, you know, it's interesting.
I don't know why that happens. It happens a lot, though.
I just stand there awkwardly.
Because typically you have the opposite problem. I mean, certainly at work, there's no lack of people wanting
to tell you what to do.
Yeah, to tell me what to do.
Sure,
you know,
bet,
in volunteer situations, though, because I've done, when you do different volunteer jobs, don't know why, but...
I don't know. They don't want to tell you what to do.
I know. There
is a thing. Literally saying, I'm here to help. I think if Mark wasn't there, I'm not lying right now. I am not lying when I tell you I was 10 seconds away from turning around, walking into that parking lot, getting in my truck, and do the old right out of the Littleton High School parking lot.
So, Chris, Mark, listen up.
You're on note. Well, Mark told me what to do, but you know, I had to go over there and ask him. He was very focused on the
Maybe this comes from the band director or something, but you know, what they really need to do is say, okay, we're putting these lights on the pants. They should give you a brief description of how they want it done.
Well, exactly. They probably did, but Dave waltzed in 15 minutes late.
10 minutes late. But you know who walked in really late, and this was the great power move. This is what you do. Chris strolls in there about 30 minutes late.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is the ultimate move, and I called him on it immediately. He comes in. He's still got his tie on. Now, he's driving from Arapahoe Community College, a good 30 minutes away. Aurora Covered Community College. Still got his tie on. Now, it's loosened, so it looks like, you know, he rushed out of work.
That's good.
I said, Chris, you just wanted to let everyone know how scary busy you are, and you still got your tie on. And he's like, yeah, pretty much. I said, good move. I like that move.
Now, are Chris and Mark the two guys you're constantly complaining about because they don't bring the donuts?
no, absolutely not. Good guys, good workers, hard workers.
They're like some of the two harder workers that I've observed.
Once those guys,
I'm talking about
there
the dads, not the
moms.
No offense, Chris.
And this is why I wasn't known, because I wasn't down there to help unload the truck or anything. I was too busy. Hello, working at my school every Saturday.
It's fine.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but
next year.
You know, it's the life of a barren parent. It never ends, and it never, it never.
So I have a kid that's in the band.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. And I have
to
tell you,
Dashiell,
listening to these stories.
Oh, you're in for it. Just wait. Dashiell's in what, seventh grade now?
Yeah, seventh grade.
Okay.
Makes me not want to be a
band
parent.
Here's the thing, though. I've got friends now that came from band.
It's a good
community. Like I've made friends.
And Chris and Mark are also
I will hang out. Out and I already have hung out with outside of band. Yeah.
Well, listen, we worked there and then what happened was we were got I guess 3/4 of the way through all the uniform pants and then we ran out.
You didn't get 3/4 of the way.
Yeah, we did. We ran out of strands of lights.
You got 1/4 of the way through.
There's no chance.
They had another work day on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And when I got there on Saturday, they had 1/3 to go.
Right. But I'm telling you, listen, the point is this. They ran out of light strands and then everybody's just standing there looking at each other. And I was like, well, you know, forget this. I'm out of here. So I got out of there. And that's the way. I do have audio of me leaving the band room. There you go. There it was. But in any case, that's been my week. Laura, how has your week been?
Good. It's been busy.
Great parade, by the way. Despite the location, a wonderful experience.
30 seconds of it.
Parade. Yeah. So. As we drove an hour down there, half an hour to find parking. Littleton was the first band. We watched 10 seconds. They walked past, right back in the car, drive home. Very interesting.
So a friend of mine, she's a dance teacher. And so she basically said her girls performed as well in that parade.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the end of that story.
Gotcha.
Dude.
Yeah.
It's an anecdote. No, it's been busy. And one thing I will say when it's busy, my brain, because I've had like just work, a lot of work going on.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Hired a part-time designer, which is very exciting for me. I'm learning how to delegate and, you know, let go of things. So, but I'm going to give 2 quick little old age examples, and then I do have another story from work.
All right.
One, I could not find my purse the morning of me volunteering at band. Okay. Could not find it. That's why I was 15 minutes late.
Yeah.
I had put it in the laundry basket the night before. My purse.
In the laundry?
I don't even put it in that room normally.
In your closet or in the basement?
No, in my closet. Basement would be really weird.
Well, that would be weird.
And then the other thing that you, Mr. Medicus, did.
Whoa, what, leave the oven on all night long?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, is that what you were going to bring up?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Yeah. Listen, hey, at least I'm cooking, huh?
Am
I right?
Long.
At least I'm cooking.
Yeah. Well, I had to, yes.
350 degrees all night long.
Didn't notice it until noon today.
Ooh. Ouch.
Well, there was obviously nothing in the oven.
No. So I have a job site that I've been on for a while and probably started the design of it a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one where like the clients have kind of moved out, just getting stuff done. But they have a cat. And don't know the name of the cat. So I'm going to call the cat Milo because I don't know the name of this cat.
Sure.
But the cat is really gregarious and the cat has stayed at the home while the clients have not been home.
Okay.
And the cat is unafraid of things like table saws, hammers, loud workmen.
Yeah.
Like this is like a cat like I've never seen before.
Right.
So we... go over there. The cat's strolling through like newly installed cabinets, you know, not flinching, coming over to get pets. He's a great cat.
Yeah.
You got to turn that down a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. You know,
yeah.
He's just a great cat.
Uh-huh.
And so Evan was telling me, this guy that I work with, that he had seen this cat because the cat goes out in the neighborhood and we're really close. We're a block away from an elementary school in Denver.
Yeah.
And he had seen this cat sitting on the other side of iron fencing from all of these small school children with their hands outstretched to the cat.
Trying to pet the
cat. And the cat was just sitting there staring at them.
Like, sucker, you can't get me.
Husband tells me, that's funny, but the cat actually went missing this weekend.
Whoa.
Someone grabbed the cat and took him to a shelter. Because he didn't have a collar on.
He's chipped?
He is not chipped, Andrew. They should have had him chipped.
My goodness.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, the husband doesn't care for this cat, so that's the other thing.
That's how we know why.
Yeah. The wife got the cat while the husband was away at some point in their marriage. So this is a great cat, though. Every time I'm over there, I give lots of pets, take lots of pictures of the cat.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't find the cat. The cat hadn't come home. The wife was upset. She finally says, I'm going to get online and look at shelters to see if he's in a shelter.
Right.
Sure enough, she gets on one of the Denver Animal Shelters websites and there's a picture of Milo staring out with a little smirk in his face, and he is misgendered,
okay, sure.
labeled yeah. as a female.
All right.
Milo is a 16-year-old black cat with a little tuxedoed white diamond.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He also is labeled as being 2 years old.
2 years old? How do they?
That's marketing.
What?
Yes, a 2-year-old female with a 16-year-old male.
That's marketing for you.
And this cat is ballsy, too. Like, wow. If you get this cat, you're going to be like, this is a 2-year-old
Wait a second.
Cat? Yeah. And so, yeah, she went and got Milo and took him home. And now he has a nice little collar
right.
around
We
him.
Do have a cat who comes around every once in a while in the courtyard right by my classroom. And sometimes I'll open up the window and he'll hop up into the window. And he's got a little collar. And on the, his little label on there, what do you call it? The little
tag,
it says, I am not lost. So... For
That's
whatever
a good
reason.
Idea. Yeah. So someone keeps taking him in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he'll jump. Like, I could have brought him right into my classroom.
They're real friendly,
times.
These city cats.
Very, very friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The lesson to be learned is all you do-gooders out there, leave the animals alone.
Yeah, leave them be.
Yeah.
Leave them be. Yeah. They're good. They can take care of themselves.
He was just looking back at my client, just looking back at her, smiling from the website.
That's
2-year-old female. He's That's just
funny.
Smirking. 16-year-old male.
But how would you know? You won't know how. I would
little,
have no idea how old our cat is.
He
by looking at him.
I will say, when I pet this cat, this 16-year-old cat, I can tell he's older.
Are there gray hairs?
He has a little bit of gray on his muzzle.
Him off as a 2-year-old?
Yes. Isn't
insane.
That funny?
That's
I know.
Funny. Yeah.
So, Andrew, how has your week been?
You know, it's busy as well. It's a busy time of the year. But, getting stuff done. But I'm just... You know, I'm kind of drained too. Like there's times I feel my age and there's times I don't.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely a time where I feel my age, right? And we got a little break coming up this weekend, which I'm looking forward to. Now, we took a trip and we had somebody watch our dog Rex.
Mm-hmm.
And Rex is this beautiful 100-pound golden retriever. And he's about like
4 pounds.
4 years old. And
130.
And so
big dog.
He is a big boy.
Big boy.
So when we got him, the week before we got him, we were babysitting, or I should say dog sitting, somebody else's golden retriever.
Mm.
And the golden retriever we were dog sitting was the most boring dog you've ever seen. No personality. I mean, basically, that dog did nothing. It didn't interact.
Huh.
And I don't know if they had this dog.
Was he depressed?
I don't know if they had the dog on Prozac or what.
They did.
Yeah. Possible.
And so it just so happened that next week we were going to pick out our puppy. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, no matter what, we're getting the dog with the most personality.
Oh.
Because the last thing I want is a dog that just sits there with no personality.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, you want to, that's what the dogs are great for.
And so.
A lot of personality.
So in this litter, there were only two puppies in the entire litter. And we had basically first pick. And so one of the dogs just kind of sat there, and then Rex was into everything. He was curious. He was into everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, that's the dog for us. Now, Rex also happened to be twice the size of the other puppy
Shocker.
In the litter. And, you know.
You should have taken note. You should have taken
note. And it's kind of like, well, you know, which one? But he was very curious and great. And he's a smart dog. He's energetic. All those things. So fast forward, zip, 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 4 years later.
I like that.
Yep. And so we had the story from 2 weeks ago. So 2 weeks ago, we get a call from our babysitter. He's like, you know, Rex did the most unbelievable thing. I'm like, and Rex has done some pretty crazy things because he is not, so 2 years ago, they had Golden Day in Colorado and they had over 1,000 golden retrievers.
I remember that. Yeah. Right.
So we decided to take Rex.
Fur just wafting in the wind.
Yeah. The wind would blow and there's literally all this golden retriever fur.
Oh, boy.
It looked like it was snowing golden retrievers.
So gross.
But of the 1,000 or more dog golden retrievers there, Rex was by far the strongest golden retriever there.
Okay, here we go.
The smartest, the strongest.
The best looking.
The best.
The brightest smile. Yes.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He is enormous.
Yeah. And so he's a strong dog. It isn't just that he's big. He is strong. Like when you walk him, I mean, he's pulling your arm out of the socket.
Mm-hmm.
And so 2 weeks ago, our babysitter had, or dog sitter had people over for Thanksgiving. You know, and we have a family friend that will stay at the house watching our pets and taking good care of them. And so they had the people that came over for Thanksgiving, they had another dog with them. And so they brought that dog's dog food and they had left it in a bag.
Oh.
And so this was canned dog food.
Okay.
So we're talking can opener, mm-hmm. canned dog food.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they left it sitting in a bag, unopened.
Fine.
The bag was
unopened. I would have thought that'd be fine.
The bags were unopened. The cans were unopened. Right?
Yeah.
So they're like, well, Rex hasn't been around for a while. Where is he? And so they went looking for him. And they go upstairs. And Rex had basically taken a can of dog food out of the bag. He took it upstairs. He crushed the can open.
What?
Yep. Like Popeye.
What?
That is insane.
And he literally, and she said the can looked like it had been run over with a car. Because he had crushed it flat with his jaws till he could squeeze every little bit of dog food out of that can.
Wow.
But, you know, she said it looked like in a room. Now, the carpet was quite a mess, too.
Oh, wow.
I will tell you, but, you know, it's just the kind of dog he is. Literally, with his jaws so strong, he could crush a metal can, just crush it open.
That is nuts.
Until the food pops out of it.
Now, that is nuts, but the nuttiest thing to me about that story is the people who would bring their dog over to someone else's house that
people
someone
do
else
that.
Is dog sitting at.
People do that all the time.
Bring their dogs over there. Do you know these other people?
No, but I think they met Rex before. But, you know, it's kind of a Colorado thing.
It's a Colorado thing. Yeah. I would tell you that, too.
That's what I don't like about
Colorado. Yeah, because you'll go to parties and stuff, and people bring their, like, oh, can I bring my dog?
Leave your dogs at
and
home.
And they'll bring their dogs.
Nobody wants to see your dog. I mean, I love Charlie.
They do
I wouldn't
that.
Bring him around.
No, I would never bring our dogs.
No, leave your dogs at home.
But you know, and so when we eat dinner, we put Rex in a cage, and we've got a cage that
crate.
You don't put him in a cage. Oh. Come on,
same thing, I guess.
Yeah, whatever.
Basically,
and I call it a cage because it's big.
It's huge.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, basically,
it's like the Barney Miller jail cell.
It's probably more than 4 feet tall. I mean, literally, like, every one of my kids could crawl in the cage, and I know this because we've tested it.
Yeah.
And,
I could get in there pretty easily, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But,
there are many a night Andrew slept in there after a heated.
Yeah, that's what happened. Well, there's no doghouse. There's the cage.
Yeah.
So tonight, you know, we got dinner, and Peter is carrying his hamburger back from the counter to the kitchen table. And Rex just grabs it out of his hand. And once Rex has food,
yeah.
you're not getting it back. It
no.
I mean, and you're not getting it back because he won't growl at you. There's none of that. It's just simply,
it's gone.
It's already
in his
belly.
It's gone.
Yeah.
So that's why, hence, I'm guessing you gave Peter your hamburger.
Oh, I should have realized that.
And this is why you're eating a big ice cream sundae when you walk through the door.
No. Katie gave Peter her hamburger.
Oh, and you ate Katie's hamburger and then you got an ice cream sundae?
No, but Katie was supposed to get me a salad and she got me the wrong salad.
Oh, how dare she?
So I went without dinner.
And what was the wrong salad?
Well, I wanted like a little garden salad and I ended up with this like chicken, this monstrous chicken salad, which I just wanted a little garden salad. So... Yeah.
So instead, he goes out to Andy's concert and buys the world's biggest ice cream sundae.
Sure.
Stands there and says, "I just got a small one." All right. Okay. Well, the best laid plans. Hey, speaking of best laid plans, if you don't have any plans, why don't you pick up Jeffrey Deaver's new book, The Midnight Lock? This is number 15 in the Lincoln Rhyme series, and I really love this one. Deaver has not missed a step. This is a very strong entry in the series. Even if you are someone who's never read a Lincoln Rhyme book, hey, you could pick this one up and read it straight away. Now, Jeffrey Deaver does a great job of explaining in my chat with him what the book is all about. So not going to waste my time doing that here. I will tell you, I loved reading this book. Loved the character of Lincoln. The suspense element kept me up at night. The courtroom drama was fascinating. And the not one, not two, but multiple major twists in this book are just what you want in a thriller. And Deaver, listen, Jeff, this is just what you want in an interview. Funny, interesting, generous. So without further ado, here he is, the great Jeffrey Deaver.
I changed the lock on my front door so you can't see me anymore. And you can't come inside my house and you can't lie down on my couch. I changed the lock on my front door.
I already know you're...
You know who I am, yeah.
That's right.
And I, you know, I've been enjoying seeing your pictures or saw your pictures from your tour in Italy. How great was it to get back on the road and
I cannot describe how good it felt. They were, you know, everyone's very cautious. The airlines, the venues, being very careful. I've had all three of my shots and have my vaccination card, which I needed to get into even the events where I was featured. Otherwise, you can't get into some venues in Italy. You saw the pictures of all my wonderful fans and the you know, the bookstores. Then you also saw the food pictures, right? Oh, yeah. There were a lot of food pictures. And I'm not going to show you my tight belt. It's open another notch after that tour. But I'm sorry, if you're in Italy, eat. That's my advice.
Are you a foodie? Do you cook yourself, or do you?
I do. I have cooked all my life. It was kind of a defensive thing. My mother was not a cook, and I'd go to friends' houses and realize, oh, there's more than meatloaf. And so it's a hobby. And until the pandemic, I would cook probably once a week, dinner party for friends and family. But that's kind of put the kibosh on that. Now we're getting back to it again, of course. And
right.
Who knows about this new variant thing, but you know, let's hope for the best.
That's right. Hope's right. I did enjoy the one picture where I saw, it was just so great to see, heartwarming to see a full room of your fans there. And then the escalator, even people sitting on the escalator. That's so nice.
They shut the escalator off so people could sit there. And I'm thinking, because I'm a thriller writer, is fire code. I mean, can they legally get 300 people into this bookstore? But apparently so. And what a delight that was. You know, I've done many, many Zoom events like this. Of course, this is an interview, but I've done book things with fans. But there's nothing like being with an audience. And I try to be funny. But if you can't see the audience, you don't know if the joke lands or if you're stepping on your own punchline. Who knows? But we're getting back to that, I hope.
Yeah, therein lies the biggest problem with the Zoom experience. And as a teacher and having to teach online and trying to be funny, that's it. You can't hear the laughter. If you can't get that feedback, that instantaneous reaction, then you just assume they're going back to sleep. And
they're rolling their eyes or doing worse. So.
Yeah. But that fire code must be pretty lax over there, because we just put on our play here and we had to have a firefighter here every night, pay him $80 an hour to sit through.
Performances. Yeah. Are you into theater?
I'm in our black box theater right now.
Interesting.
Anyway, let's talk about your book. I loved your new book, The Midnight Lock. This is another captivating and entertaining entry in the Lincoln Rhyme series, this creepy tale of doll babies, jolly ranchers, bump keys, and wackadoo crackpot conspiracy theorists. Jeffrey Deaver, what was it that inspired you to write this entry?
Well, hello, Dave. So delighted to talk to you. And I wanted that introduction. I know it's copyrighted. You created it, but I'd like to steal that.
You got it.
To the book. Okay, thank you. Well, I was a lawyer, so now we have it on tape. That's a contract. I just want you to know that. So, all right, I'll tell you where it came from. First of all, I should say my books to the folks in the audience. I want to write a very captivating book, a roller coaster of a book, one that moves very quickly, and one that will keep readers on the edge of their seats, palm sweating from the first page to the last. Well, what that means is I'm always looking for ideas that will grab readers by the throat in the opening scene. And about two years ago, I was locked out of my house. And I called a locksmith, and wisely, the locksmith verified it was my house. And so he pulled out the little tools, and in like 10 seconds, the door was open. And I thought two happy thoughts. First happy thought, I'm back in my house. I can feed my dogs now. They won't be destitute.
Very important.
And second happy thought, I've got my new book idea. And that became the core of The Midnight Lock. And very simply, what happens is this nefarious fellow, he is an expert lock picker. And now I don't mean these electronic locks, you know, that we see and you pull your, it's an app, you know, like a 13-year-old could hack into those.
That's
and
exactly,
they do
yeah.
daily.
That's, thanks for that's, making that me feel secure, because I have one of those in my house. So thank you.
Oh, okay.
Now another.
Yeah, you want to check it right now, Dave, just to make sure nobody's hacked in. anyway, I wanted to create this guy who could pick the metal locks, you know, the locks on our doors that go back hundreds, even thousands of years. And so I studied a lot about the history of locks, and he is obsessed with locks, and he picks them late at night, no matter how complicated the lock is. And he gets in after midnight, as the title suggests, when you're fast asleep. And what does he do? He doesn't kill anybody. No. He doesn't even touch anybody. He moves things around and then he leaves. But Lincoln Rhyme, my hero, and Amelia Sachs, his partner and now wife, the crime solvers in New York City, know that something else is going on, and indeed something else is going on. And they get on the case to track this guy down and find out what the truth really is and what he's up to. Is he working for somebody? Is there something else going on? And that's the basic premise of the book. It takes place over about 2 days, has lots of reversals. You know, chapter three ends with a big surprise. Chapter four ends with a big surprise. And then there's a big twist ending. And after that, there's a big twist ending. And then after that, there's a big twist
ending. It just kept coming.
No. There's not a technical thing here like the old albums were sticking and jumping back. No, there are three and a half big twist endings to the Midnight Lock.
That's right. I mean, you're a giver, Jeffrey Deaver. You're a giver. You just kept giving, and I love that. And well, I think it was maybe the first of the three that really. Well, we don't want to get into it. They're fantastic. They're absolutely fantastic. But and there was also a nice reveal. I feel halfway through that I also really enjoyed. So you just kept it coming throughout the whole novel. And
well, thank you.
It really is entertaining and suspenseful, but it did scare the hell out of me, because that is the creepiest thing to think about. A guy, this is, you're in the, your home is your sanctity. I mean, this is your safe spot. And to think about not only just someone coming in there to inflict harm upon you, but just the fact that they're coming in, rearranging stuff, putting even doll babies in your bed or what have you, and then getting out of there. And then you're left to wonder, wait a second, I couldn't have done that. What the hell is going on there? So
yes, with all respect to the lovely artistic Madame Alexander dolls. And I don't know, you know, anyone who collects the collectible items. And then of course, you know, children play with them and collect them, but imagine waking up, you know, and you're kind of groggy and you turn over and, staring at you from the other pillow is a Madame Alexander doll. You know, it's not Chucky, which may be a little over the top. I found this a little creepier, but you make a very, very good point there. We've all, you know, read serial killer books, and I'm frankly kind of tired of serial killers. And the fact is, serial killers exist. They're out there, and they, you know, they cause terrible harm. It's rare, but it does happen. But all the, if an alien were to come to the planet Earth and start reading thriller fiction, he'd say, serial killers in every town. I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I'm going back to the planet Xantar where it's safe. But I thought I want to do something different. And imagine if somebody basically took your home away from you. It's like it got burned down because you're never going to stay there again. And in fact, there's when Lincoln Rhyme is trying to solve the case, and I lived in Manhattan for a long time, and we know about Manhattan real estate. It's such a premium. Yeah, Lincoln thinks, is it possible he works for a real estate agent to try to get people out of the apartment? Because in New York City, there are controls on rent. If somebody's living there, you can only raise the rent so much. If they leave, then you can up the rent to market value. And of course, market value could be $6,000 a month. It's completely outrageous. But that is not, that turns out, I'm giving this away, but that turns out not to be the case. There's actually something much more significant going on. And I don't want to talk too much about that because it's a twist, but I will say that in Hollywood, they say, this book or movie is, Jaws meets Cinderella, which would actually be a pretty good movie now that I think
it would be. You might be onto something there.
Yeah, but anyway, this is what I call Succession, that great TV show about the media empire, meets Dexter, if you want to look at it that way. And so I get into media. I get into the idea of fake news. I get into the bloggers who create these conspiracy movements that can affect people's lives. You know, I think about the Pizzagate thing where the blogger talked about this, child trafficking ring in the basement of a real pizza parlor in or outside of Washington, D.C. And this fellow went there with a gun to save the children Well, he didn't bother to check out that there was no basement in this place. And he randomly, with his rifle, randomly fired a shot into a closet. My thinking is, if you're going to save children, don't shoot into where they may be. That's a bad
idea. That's an idea.
But that was all because of a fake story in a blog. So the book gets into that as well. I think even thrillers, the genre stories that I write, which are there for entertainment, it helps to have a broader theme or broader topic, a broader message, because that way the book stays with you a little bit longer. I want people to think a bit after they close the book and they read that final page.
And it is what helps it resonate and bring it home. And that, to me, was the scariest character in it, that blogger putting the message out there. I hope you didn't have to listen to too much, right-wing radio to
I did listen to some of it. And, that's not my source of media. I listen to the, I listen to NPR, I'm hesitating because I was going to say newspapers. Well, they're newspapers. I just don't get the paper.
Right.
Subscribe to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. Those are real newspapers. You know, their reporters check attribution. They get multiple sources. That's NPR is the same way. This is serious reporting. Many other news stations, both television and radio, do that. But that's a theme that I think is important. But I listen to some of those wackos out there, and oh my gosh, it's astonishing that what they can get away with.
That's true. And that people will believe it. But now you write about this lock picking in the midnight lock with such incredible detail. Obviously you did a lot of research on lock picking. I love how you give the whole history, and I'm imagining these huge wooden keys back in the day, but I got to know, did you actually try yourself to pick a lock?
Sure. Sure. I when I saw the lockpick do that, I thought, I'm going to write about that, but I also want to be credible when I write about things. So I always do a lot of research for my books. And, you know, if you like, we can kind of talk about how I construct these books, because it's...
Oh, absolutely.
It's unique. I mean, I have an approach that not a lot of other authors do. I'm not saying mine's better, but it just is...
Well, it works for you, right?
Yeah, exactly. But research, a lot of research, a lot of book research. I did talk to that locksmith. I called him up and asked a few questions, but I thought, well, of course I'm going to try it myself. And you can buy lockpicks, it's completely legal. So I did. And I thought, I'm not quite sure how to do this. They didn't come with an instruction book, but I went to that. I know they, if you buy at least the set I bought, I'm sure there were other ones. Uh-huh. I got the cheap one. So maybe
you don't want to go all out. You don't know.
I was going to save a little bit of money there, but I went to that fount of knowledge, that reservoir of all information that's ever existed in the universe, YouTube.
Yes, yes.
And I watched, and there's instructions there, and you have this thing called a tension tool that you kind of hold the tumbler. There's this cylinder in it. You hold it, and then you use this thing that looks like a dentist pick to push the pins up. The pins are what hold the lock. And I thought, okay, 10 seconds for the lock pick, 10 minutes for me. 2.5 hours later, and some language that I would not be appropriate for our conversation.
Yeah.
And I put it down to the fact that I was distracted by my dogs, who were staring at me thinking, what's he up to? It is quite an art and a science, but I did get I knew how it works. So I assuaged my bad feelings by reminding myself that this is how it's done. It's just that I had to go edit the book. I didn't have time to keep.
Oh, sure.
Keep
sure. Yeah,
that was my, that was my excuse. So. But the good news is that if the book stuff doesn't work out, I'm going to have to find another career other than being a burglar, because that's not going to work for me.
So you weren't. So you weren't ultimately successful. You spent 2.5 hours and you didn't.
And while we're talking, my website is jeffreydeaver.com. If anybody wants to buy a set of lockpicks, just email me and let me know.
Okay, great. I'll look into that. But so you were talking about your process. How does the process work? So you get idea for your book, and then where do you go from there with it?
Yeah, well, I get a great idea for a book, what I hope will be a great idea. And the first thing is I do not write the book. I outline the book. The world of authors is divided into two camps, the plotters, Those are people who outline, and the pantsers, right, as in seat of the pants. And I am a I am an outliner. I spend 8 months structuring the book. I start with a big board that's in that I could walk with my computer into the other room, except that's where my dogs are, and they would photobomb our interview. But it's a big cork board. I put post-it notes up, and the idea starts. Psychotic lock picker breaks into apartments. That's it. But then I stare at the board, and ideas start coming to me. I put in the upper, in my upper right-hand corner, he breaks into one apartment. He's got to break into another apartment. Then in the middle, I say breaks into apartment two, reveal here about identity, another reveal here, clue put in here, because I have all those surprise endings and they have to relate to a clue. Well, I could go on and on about this, but at the end of the maybe 3 months, I've got 70 or 80 of these post-it notes, and each one represents a scene, not necessarily a chapter, but a scene in the book where we shift a point of view or the time changes. And then I move to the computer and keep modifying it. And I should say the outline is not Sister Mary Elizabeth's classic outline from sixth grade, which is Roman numeral one.
Oh, that's the worst. And so, yeah.
These are just bullet points.
Sure. Yeah.
Eventually I number them. And only when the outline is done and the research is done, do I sit down and write the book. And I cannot express to potential writers out there how important an outline is, because if you outline, you're never going to have a block. And if you're in the midst of the outline and you realize, you know what, there's no middle to this story and there's no ending, there's no surprise ending. Well, then you're trying to write a book that should not be written. Haven't we all read those? A yes, book that should not have been written?
Yes.
And that often happens because somebody just sits down, writes with a good idea and gets, you know, maybe halfway through and then doesn't know where to go and puts in these cliches in the middle and the an ending that's, you know, the ending that's from out of left field, the killer we never met before. And it's unsatisfying. Our job as authors is to treat readers like our gods. We owe them the best we can possibly do. And that means a riveting story all the way through. The great pulp fiction writer, Mickey Spillane from the 50s and 60s, detective fiction writer, said, people don't read books to get to the middle. Think about it. We don't pick up a 500-page book saying, I cannot wait to get to page 250 and put it down. It's our job to do that. And outlining really, really helps. So I'm a firm outliner. Once that's done, I can write the book very, very quickly. It takes me, maybe 2 months to bang out the first draft. And then I rewrite, do a lot of revision too.
And that, you know, that is a great point, because I don't know how many times I've read a book and you get to the end and then it just drags on. And there's, like you said, there's cliche after cliche. I didn't even think about it, but no doubt that's a result of someone who has that great idea and can't bring it to fruition.
The ending of the book is the most important part. And I can prove that because I travel a lot as an author on book tour. I just got back from Italy on book tour, and I went to Phoenix on book tour. It's really good to see fans again.
Yeah.
Being careful, I'm vaccinated, wear a mask. Right. We have to be safe, but it's still so good to do that. But here's why I know the ending of a book is the most important part, because the ending of a flight, the landing, is the most important part of the flight. I don't want the pilot to say, ladies and gentlemen, we gave you a great takeoff and I hope you enjoyed those peanuts we gave you, and it was a very smooth flight, but we can't get the wheels down. So there's going to be a little bit of a problem on landing. No, I want wheels on landing, and I want a really good ending for a book.
That's a good point. It's also it's the last impression. Your last thought is going to be that, like a lot of times I'm a high school theater teacher, and I tell the kids all the time, the last impression the audience is going to have of you is you bowing and taking the curtain call. So, you know, a lot of times.
Well, actually, Dave, I was just going to mention, because you had mentioned before you were a teacher, and I teach courses in writing. And I tell my students, the first scene sells that book. The final scene sells your next book.
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Look at Jeffrey. You should copyright that. That's a good one there, Jeffrey.
I did, but you can license it from me. I happen to have a contract. No. I have a contract right here, and you can just sign it digitally.
Yeah. We'll get that taken care of. You were a lawyer. I didn't realize you were a lawyer. How long did that last?
Yeah, I wasn't a lawyer for very long. Well, that sounds bad, doesn't it? I left intentionally. I've always wanted to be a writer ever since I was a little kid. But you can't be a prodigy writer. You know, Jackson Pollock was spilling paint on his mother's floor when he was a kid. And Mozart, we know, was composing when he was in the single digits, when he was very young. But writers have to live for a while. So I was in no hurry to get published. I was a journalist for a while. I was a lawyer for a while. Then I transitioned into writing fiction full time. You know, people say, and I like being a lawyer, but people say, well, you write crime stories, Jeff, and you were a lawyer. You must have been a criminal lawyer. And I tell them, well, I'll tell you what, I represented big banks on Wall Street. You draw your own conclusions. And did I pick up some material there? Maybe I did, but I can't say.
Yeah, I do love, and you start out with a great courtroom scene at the beginning of the book, you know, with Lincoln, having to, back up some evidence. Well, I love that scene. It starts off.
Well,
with,
thank you.
You said great beginning.
Well, that was a very, very fun scene to write because I didn't do a lot of litigation, but I was in court a little bit. And I've always liked the concept of law. Mm-hmm. I still read a lot about it, but I never wanted to write a legal thriller, you know, a la John Grisham, because the law takes a long time. You know, we see in what are some of the shows? Boston Legal, I think, and yeah. LA Law. Those are great shows.
Law and Order.
But the reality is that a trial takes forever. And if you're writing a novel about it, that it just moves slowly. That you have to introduce evidence and so forth. But in the Midnight Lock, there's a very pivotal scene where most of the trial has gone on before the book opens. Right. And here's Lincoln on the in court on the hot seat because he may have made a forensic mistake. And his whole career, of course, he's a criminalist. He's a forensic scientist. His whole career is based on not making mistakes. He's a genius. And he has no tolerance for people who make mistakes. And yet he may have, and I use that verb because I don't want to give anything away, but it was very fun to write that scene, write a nefarious and slick defense attorney, write a prosecutor who's a little over his head, and Lincoln Rhyme being the curmudgeon and the quip master that he is, coming back and dueling with the defense attorney and dueling with the judge a little bit too. And that's a scene that some people, the book is just out, but some people who read it, some attorneys have said it kind of kept them on the edge of their seat to see what was going to happen because it's a very exciting scene that launches a second plot. I have three or four subplots.
Yeah, and it was great to see. It was interesting to see Lincoln have to kind of squirm there. And, you know, it's interesting to start a book where your hero is put on the hot seat like that. And they go from there. So,
well, in my books, I feel kind of bad for my characters because I phrase it, I put them in a pressure cooker and turn the heat up as high as it can go. And poor Lincoln and Amelia in this one. And I write another series featuring my character, Coulter Shaw, who's this itinerant hero. He travels around looking for rewards. And I think one of the reviews said he gets into more trouble than Carter has liver pills. And nobody knew what that was. It's I guess the product is still out there, but it's kind of from my past or my grandmother's past.
That's so old. Yeah.
It's really old. It's like a liver. I have no idea what it does, which is a pill that apparently does something for your liver. And I said, wait a minute. I kind of remember that. And there were a lot of pills. I mean, I guess the reviewer could have said the Tylenol has pills in their bottle, but it was liver pills. So anyway, Coulter Shaw gets into a lot of trouble. I just love that. You know, my books are not literary crime fiction. They don't move slowly. They're not introspective studies of the deep psychology of crime. That's fine. Those books are great. These are roller coasters. You sign on and it's probably a 2-day read at best. And I've already heard from people who've read it in one sitting, but then they're angry. They say, now I have to wait another year, Jeffrey. And I say, well, hold on. There are 45 other books out there. You can go back and read some of the backlist.
How did you know this one was going to be a Lincoln Rhyme book? You know,
any book that I wanted to, I wanted Lincoln Rhyme to come back. I've written three Coulter Shaw books in a row.
Right.
That was The Never Game, which, by the way, will be a CBS TV show next year. So The Never Game, wow, The Goodbye Man, and the Final Twist. So, oh, thank you. Thank you. Those are the three Coulter Shaw books. Now it was time for a Lincoln because people were clamoring for Lincoln. And my job is, you know, I want to do what the readers want. Authors who say, I don't care about the readers. Well, that's nonsense. You know, I'm a manufacturer. I'm Procter & Gamble. Do you think I wake up and say, well, I'm Procter & Gamble. Okay, the consumers, I don't care what they're, I'm making liver-flavored toothpaste. That's what, no more mint. We're doing liver-flavored toothpaste. No, if fans want mint-flavored books, right, they're getting mint-flavored books. So Lincoln is back. There'll be a Coulter Shaw next year, okay, another Lincoln after that.
That's great, because there was some speculation that you were just going to end it as a trilogy. So I'm glad to see. I do enjoy those Coulter Shaw.
Oh, well, thank you. Coulter will be back. And boy, he's in more trouble than Carter has liver pills.
Is that a Jimmy Carter reference or a Billy Carter?
Billy
Carter was a big drinker. I don't know.
Well, maybe it was. Oh, so maybe they help your liver. Let me see. Well, I'm drinking coffee here, but I've been known to have a glass of wine occasionally.
So. There you go. I'm sure when you were in Italy, you got some nice wines over there. Some nice vino as you were sitting on your
Some very good. Well, I mean, on my Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, if you're interested, you can go to those sites and take a look at some of the food I had over there. It's a, you know, Italy is a country of readers. Many, many people appeared at my event, a country of culture, a country of, a country of food and wine. It was a great treat to be over there.
What was your favorite meal? What was the pièce de résistance over there?
Oh boy, that's really tough. But I think I will say I went to restaurant owned by, I can't recall the name of it. I think it's simply called Carlo Cracco's restaurant. Carlo Cracco is like the Gordon Ramsay of Italy. He was an Iron Chef host and that level of cuisine, Michelin starred, I'm sure. And I was in Milan and there's actually a dish I make called Cotoletta Milanese, and it's a veal cutlet. It's breaded and served with lemon on it. It's cooked very quickly. You know, the scallopine, you pound it flat. Ah, but Carlo Cracco doesn't pound it flat. It's a thick piece of veal in the wonderful crust served with lemon. And I didn't need a knife to eat it.
It
was so tender. And I started with an octopus, grilled octopus, and had that. And it was just a wonderful meal. I'm getting hungry now having this conversation.
I know. Now I'm starving. I haven't eaten breakfast yet. Do you try to get out I know when I travel and I eat too much, you know, it's kind of burdensome. Do you try to get a little exercise in while you're out and about? You take some walks?
I did. I'm not a big exercise person, although I have one of these things. It's not a Fitbit, but it's like that. Ah, there we go.
I got an Apple Watch.
And but just by nature of the book tour, I did a lot of walking from one place to another, from a restaurant to a radio studio or a TV studio to a bookstore. And that's my go-to exercise. I walk a lot and I hit, it was kind of ironic. My goal is 10,000 steps. And I think that's about 4 miles or something like that. And that's great. Of course, ironically, I look at the calorie and I burned like one piece of toast. It's just so irritating. But anyway,
it depends how fast you're walking, you know, you need to do that.
I guess that's it. Yeah. I'm a pretty slow walker, but it was ironic. I wasn't paying attention to it. And I get back to the hotel and I'm exhausted, but I need to get a drink. So I, you know, kind of wash up and I'm going to go to my computer and I walk from the bathroom in the hotel room to the mini bar to get a little miniature of, Canadian whiskey. So I have some there. So, and it was on that walk to the bar that I hit 10,000 steps.
Yes.
And you know, I don't know about yours, but this, it goes,
right,
like,
yep,
it shows a prize.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I thought, little does it know I'm drinking. It would like erase the last 1,000 steps if it knew I was walking to the bar. So
It's nice. It's the little things, you know, when you see the little fake confetti come out, it's just those,
mine does the confetti thing too.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. It's so nice. Do you, you have any interesting writing quirks that you do while you're writing or
they call those fetishes, you know, writing fetishes that people have to use a certain pen or pencil. Yeah, and, no, I mean, the only thing I do is make sure the technology is up to date. I have to get a new computer about every 8 months because I burn through the keyboard, the computer, the processor works fine, but I write 8-10 hours a day on it. The keys, I'm looking at my keyboard right now, the A, D, C, G, N, and P, and the O keys are gone. You can't see them, but I can touch type, so that's not a problem.
Wow.
But I get the latest technology, and then I write anywhere. I write here. I'm in my kitchen right now. I have an office. I write on airplanes. I wrote, I had a flight delay, a 4-hour flight delay. I got 2 chapters written for my new book. When I teach my course, I tell my students, you know, you're a craftsperson. You use the best tools you can get, but don't sentimentalize it. That's not what this is about. You're a surgeon. You know, a surgeon goes into the operating room and she uses the best technology. She does the job and she leaves. A pilot, they fly the airplane, they land. That's your job. Do the best you can and then get on with another project.
Nice. Well, Jeffrey Deaver, listen, thank you so much for chatting with me. It's been a pleasure, as always. I would take your writing. Sign me up. Where can I take this writing course?
They're starting to come back now. Look at my website, again, jeffreydeaver.com. I say in the interest of shameless self-promotion.
Sure, that's what we're here for.
Even if you're not a writer, people have told me they come to appreciate books better when they know how they're constructed. And, you know, there's a thing about a book I'm going to read about airplanes, construction of airplanes. Well, I'm never going to build an airplane, but I think I'm looking forward to reading it. It's kind of a how-to book. So I think that should be fun, but check out jeffreydeaver.com. And if you're interested in how I write books and anything else, you'll see it there.
Sounds great. Listen, loved your book, The Midnight Lock, and I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Good talking.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much to Jeffrey Deaver. Enjoyed that conversation and enjoyed the book, The Midnight Lock. Check it out. Let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
Yeah, let's start with
the Inside Flap.
Oh. And this is the Inside Flap. My big beefy fingers hit the wrong button. How about we start with
Andrew.
No, oh my God, I can't. You know what it is?
What?
I got the iPad on the, because we're recording now in the living room. We haven't set up the recording studio yet. And by studio, I mean your workroom. But I got the iPad on the couch arm, and I'm only wearing one contact. So my depth perception is off. So I can't see which button is which. There we go.
Medicus.
Let's start with Laura Medicus.
Thank
there you.
You.
Go. Okay.
So I have a book called Bewilderment by Richard Powers. Mm. And so this book is on a lot of book lists, best books of 2021. New York Times, I think the Washington Post also. So this book was a nominee for the Booker Prize and the National Book Award this year. And
heard of it.
I'm here to tell you, no, it's really
good. Oh, worth it.
It's really good.
All right.
So this is a powerful and dark story about a very troubled 9-year-old boy and his astrophysicist father. Mm. So if you're looking for something to reaffirm your fears about where our country is headed, where our planet is headed, this is the book for you.
Your old theme song is back.
Thank you.
Yep.
So this is quite a few different things. So it's climate fiction.
Yeah.
Can I get a ding?
Oh, sure. If I can see.
This is speculative fiction, science fiction, dystopian, and
what?
A love story about a father's love for his son.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. So, you know, I usually don't.
That's a lot of genres.
Oh, no. Yeah, Andrew.
So, Laura, I have to ask here.
Oh, no.
The term speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that like redundant? I mean, isn't all fiction kind of speculative?
For me, speculative fiction takes what if this was possible? And usually it is 7 Eves or what if this happened? Like, what if a meteor was going to destroy our moon? Right.
Now you read more spec fiction than any of us. So
then it plays out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I usually don't like tragedies at all. Don't like to watch tragedies. Mm-hmm. I don't like to read tragedies. This book gripped me right from the start. Robin, the 9-year-old, he's on the verge of getting kicked out of school for violent behavior. To me, he seemed like he was autistic, but they don't label him that way. Yeah. His mother recently died, and he and his dad, they are just barely living from day to day. Robin needs calm, care, attention, like steadiness. And his father, named Theo, is just struggling to be what his son needs him to be because he's mourning too. And his son kind of needs him to be both a mother and a father. And Theo is having trouble with that, which seems mm-hmm. natural. Yeah. He does not want to put his son on medication, which is what the school is almost ready to demand. That okay. his son gets medicated before they put him back in school.
Yeah.
So he enlists him in a biofeedback project that's being done by a former friend of his wife's. And this is where the speculative part gets in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of science in this book that maybe this is something that might be able to happen to help depression, mental illness of other kinds in the future.
Yeah.
It's not available now, but it's something that the way it's described, you think that might work.
Yeah.
So, the other interesting thing that's being done, this book is set, in an America where fascism has won.
Whoa.
So there are no democratic elections. You have to be careful what you say about the government. And it alludes to that half of the country is already split from the other. Like there has been a civil war, a civil separation.
It sounds familiar.
It sounded very familiar. Yeah. So the biofeedback that Robin goes through changes his brain and his behavior in a very unique way. And I don't want to give it away because it's detailed. And it was kind of surprising to me how they did it. But it helps him out so much. And there's a lot of real science in here that people like Andrew will enjoy, but people like me, it did not slow me down or hamper my enjoyment at all. I read it. I didn't think too hard about it, but if you want to think hard about it, there's some details and stuff like that.
Well, that's just like what Andy Weir said, you know, it's there. So if you're into that kind of thing,
yeah,
you can dig it, but if it doesn't, it's not necessary to like he said, he doesn't mind people just skimming over that. So
another thing I liked about this book. So the dad, Theo, is an astrophysicist and all he does is look for life out there.
Mm.
So the question over and over in the book is asked, where is everyone? Because it's a huge galaxy. Yeah. There's galaxies and galaxies.
Great question. Where the hell is everybody?
Where is everyone?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of imaginative talk about life on other planets and the struggle to find life that's out there. Yes, Andrew.
You know, and there's all the books I read.
Yeah.
And
where there's already life everywhere. Yeah.
And most of the science fiction book is, okay, we're looking for life, but when they find it.
Yeah.
It is typically a disaster.
That's true. That is so true.
Now, is that one of the reasons why you like that? You like to imagine other worlds being, or is it, you know?
Kind of. I
find that comforting a little bit.
It's escapism for me. Like, you know, I don't want to read about problems that could be my problems. Mm-hmm. I want to escape from CNN and Fox News and all that stuff. You know, I want to, I also think it kind of expands my mind. And also a lot of the stuff I read is, you know, it's basically, it's testing things. It's testing ideas. And, you know, it's kind of cool to see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. So I liked that part of the book, this imagining other worlds. And he tells his son stories about planets that haven't been discovered yet and about what life would be like. And they're like little nods to other science fiction books that have come before.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nod to Flowers of Algernon also in this book.
Right.
It's a powerful, well-written, thoughtful, genre-bending, but I found it tragic story about a father and a son and just a world, our world, that's limping to the end.
Yeah.
Basically.
All right. Sounds, sounds
it's
like
very good. It's very well written.
It's interesting because it really doesn't sound like something you would read.
It doesn't sound like
except
anything
in some
I
ways
would read.
It does. So
I know because it's got that apocalyptic angle. Yeah.
Now, on a scale of 1 to 5,
mm-hmm.
How many tissue packets would you rate this book?
I didn't cry. Oh, maybe a couple tears at the end. Huh. But that's it.
Well,
this was not...
Not a tearjerker.
No, this was not a tearjerker.
No razor blade tears coming out.
This is more soul crushing.
All right, say no more. And yet that book is still heartily recommended by...
So if you're looking for some soul crushing... Yeah. Pick up Bewilderment this Christmas.
My book is not so crushing. It is a thriller. It is called The Stolen Hours by Alan Eskins. Now, this is a writer who I really admire. I've recommended another one of his novels called Nothing More Dangerous on the show before. And when I was in the library perusing around, I saw this book on this shelf. And as fast as you could imagine, my hand darted out and snatched it before anyone else could get it, because you know I'm greedy like that. I'll do that. I'll grab a book.
Was it on Lucky Day?
I believe so. I'm not sure. I don't remember. It might have been. So this is a thrilling book featuring a female prosecutor working her way up in the firm, and one day in court, as she's working for a male boss who, for whatever reason, has it out for her, she kind of freezes up in the courtroom, and this is like her one chance to kind of prove herself. One of her first days
she
in court.
She get the yips.
Kind of. She kind of got the yips. She stumbles badly and is unable to recover, and another woman has to take over for her. So this is, seems to be the reason that her boss is looking for to get rid of her. However, there was a good reason why she froze up like that, why she got those yips. Turns out that the defendant in the case, when she saw him, she recognized him, and she believes it is the same man who many years earlier attacked and assaulted her. Now here he is in court facing charges of sexual assault and attempted murder.
Is she the prosecutor?
Yes, that is correct. So now this guy, Gavin Spencer is his name. He is an actual serial killer. And even worse, he's a... So shout out to Dan Clark, our friend Dan Clark. I should have said what he is.
Separated first. Here.
Dan Clark, not a serial killer.
No.
But Dan Clark is a wedding photographer, as is Gavin Spencer. Is he not doing that anymore?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Maybe he's more into his Mama Bird media business. Mm-hmm. But in any case, Gavin Spencer is a wedding photographer, and he kind of finds his victims by going around at these weddings and taking pictures, and he finds his next victim. And there's really great chapters written from Gavin Spencer's point of view that are really chilling. And you think you know your local wedding photographer, and then they go do something like assault women and you know, throw them in the Mississippi River. Very scary stuff. So along with this creep, the book is written from the point of view of a female detective named Nikki, and of course the prosecutor, whose name is Lila. This is a very fast-paced, well-written thriller from Alan Eskins. You're going to love the character of Lila as she, along with Nikki, attempt to bring this killer to justice. And you find out why this killer really didn't mind being put in jail and how it was all part of his master plan. And the way he writes from the killer's point of view in this book is really cool. This is a real cat-and-mouse affair with plenty of twists and turns along the way that really keep the pages flying. This was scary, realistic, and the subplots involving Lila and her male boss who's out to get her had you rooting for Lila throughout as she attempted to prove herself. This is not soul crushing like yours. This is almost more life affirming and a lot of fun to read.
Mine's definitely not that.
A lot. This is called The Stolen Hours by Alan Eskins and recommended by
Dave Medicus.
This guy right here. Andrew. What do you got?
So my book isn't soul crushing.
Okay.
It is planet crushing.
Word of the day.
So I'm going to one-up both of you
on this one.
Okay.
Several orders of magnitude. And so this is written by Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Oh.
And no, I cannot spell.
Really?
I cannot spell that for you.
Like Tchaikovsky?
Yeah.
Tchaikovsky.
Tchaikovsky. Adrian. And he is an award-winning author.
Huh.
But this book is called...
It's called
The Shards of Earth. And this book was nominated for a Goodreads, you know, best science fiction book.
For this year.
Yep. And you know, Adrian Tchaikovsky has also won the Arthur C. Clarke Award, you know, for science fiction. So... This is really a great book. It is an epic space opera. I assume you can call it a space opera. Yeah. And
there you go. Here's your space opera music.
I can't hear the word space opera without hearing that theme song now.
You got to play it.
So the
not that I hear space opera in my day-to-day life.
How often do you hear that?
Only with Andrew.
Yeah.
So the opening of this book, it is a war against the architects. They're called the architects. Hmm. And the galaxy and all these different races are united in the war against the architects. Now, the architects, and you'll soon learn why they're called architects, but they fly around, you know, the universe in moon-sized ships.
Moon-sized ships?
Moon-sized ships.
Good God.
And so nobody can communicate with the architects, right? Nobody knows how they think. Nobody knows how they work.
Like real architects.
Well, that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, good one.
Yeah.
Hey, shout out to Aaron.
Hi, Aaron.
Our architect who worked on us with the addition.
Hi, John.
Yeah, and John. I don't know John, but...
I work with him all the time.
Can I tell you, I got an architect story for you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were going to do a kitchen remodel,
uh-huh.
Like, you know, 12 years ago. And so Katie and I, we hired an architect. Now the architect comes into the house and he says, Andrew and Katie, I want you to pretend that you're Bruce Springsteen and you just tell me what your deepest desires are and I will draw that up for you.
Hmm.
And I'm sitting there thinking, well, I'm not Bruce Springsteen.
What?
I don't have Bruce Springsteen.
A gajillion dollars, yeah.
And I'm honestly thinking, I really ought to just show this guy the door.
What does that even mean?
So, you know, and so basically... let him know what we wanted. We let him know what the constraints were for the project.
Mm-hmm. Scope of work and all.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm sitting there thinking, you know, he's going to draw us a design. How bad can it be? Well, in any case, this guy comes back with like 8 different drawings, not a single one of which listened to any of the requirements. I mean, he built additions on additions and like, of course the bill was for 6 different sets of drawings, none of which we could basically use it all. So,
wow.
Like, you know, if you're dealing with an architect and your initial instinct is to throw them out the front door.
Yeah.
Just put that foot to work and kick them the hell out. So that's my architect story. Anybody who's worked with architects probably has a few interesting anecdotes. So these architects...
No comment.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I work with 2 regularly and I really like them.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
let's
so
say
these,
that
these architects
I do.
These architects you could say are a galactic pain in the ass.
Oh okay. Boy!
And so moon-sized ships,
mm-hmm.
and they are truly alien. Like nobody can communicate. Nobody knows, you know, what makes them tick. Nobody knows what they want. I mean, they're alien in the fact that nobody. They just don't function like regular living beings. And so what happens is the galaxy unites to fight a war because what these architects do is they will take planets and, you know, within a few minutes or hours, they will completely re-architect the planet, killing all life on the planet.
Oh.
And basically, you know, turning like the planets into like these super sculptures that seem to have no form, or they've got form, but no function.
Whoa.
And they will wipe out, you know, all life and everything.
This guy, Adrian Jutkowski, he must hate architects.
And you wonder if he has an architect story.
Yeah.
And so
wow.
And so they're fighting the war because they know that if the architects come, they've not been able to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, they've been unsuccessful.
Huh.
If they show up, you're done. You need to just turn around and get the hell out of there. And so the conventional weapons have had no effect. You know, united alien species fighting against them have no effect. Nobody knows what they want. Nobody knows why they're doing what they're doing, right? I mean, so there's this mystery, but it's this really, sinister mystery too. Is, you know, why are they doing what they're doing?
Mm.
And so they come up with these altered humans, and they're using sort of like, psionic enhanced humans, and they're actually able to eventually destroy one of the architect ships, basically using these enhanced humans, and fighting them, somehow with mind power. And so that's successful, and the architects disappear. You know, and again, nobody knows what they want, what they're doing, but they disappear for 50 years, okay. Right? So 50 years, I mean, you know, so the galaxy had a reason with the architects around to unite against a common enemy. Now the architects are gone. Everybody wants to think they're gone for good, but nobody knows for sure. And so there's a ship called the Vulture of God. And the Vulture, and basically what's happening is some of the people that fought this war 50 years ago, they're coming back together. And one of these, you know, psionically enhanced humans, his name is Idris. And the psionically enhanced humans are typically considered property, because people have learned that they can make a lot of money by using these enhanced humans, mostly because they use them to really, you know, for faster than light travel, to travel around the universe much faster.
Okay.
And so most of them are considered property. Well, Idris is not considered property. And so the crew that fought this war 50 years ago successfully, the crew that was actually able to turn back or destroy this architect moon-sized ship, they're all kind of getting back together, right? And not willingly, kind of, you know, reluctantly, because they don't want to relive the past.
Mm.
Everybody is hoping that the architects are gone. They're hoping,
sure,
that their history.
Yeah.
And so, but of course, that's not the case.
Never is.
Yeah. And so the crew of the Vultures of God, they go out on a salvage mission where a ship has not been heard from. And of course, when they see, they find the ship, and they know immediately the architects have basically taken the ship and transformed it into some sort of a weird sculpture. Right?
Wow.
It's a funny book.
Yeah. And so, you know, and they also know, like, you know, this would happen in seconds. It would take the architects no time whatsoever. I mean, literally snap their fingers. And so the architects, like, their technology, I mean, they're almost godlike in terms of their capabilities. Now, you would think that the galaxy would want to know that the architects are backed. But what's happening is some people want to hide the information. You know, some people, they want to come out with the information. And so there's all these different factions that are now, you know, after the crew of the Vulture of God, to either take advantage of the crew, to either, you know, make sure they don't tell what the secrets that they found, right? Or to basically get them to share the secrets. So now, you know, rather than there being some united front, the galaxy is completely divided. And the Vulture of God is basically, you know, kind of chasing the tail of this mystery. But, you know, they basically have to watch at every single turn for basically, you know, dangers. I mean, it's like, you know, literally out of the frying pan into the fire. And so this is the book. It is an epic novel. There is a great amount of detail. There is compelling character development. This is not a book, I wouldn't say it's an easy read. This is not a book where you're going to sit back and just read it. This is a thought-provoking novel. And you know, this would be my choice for the Goodreads science fiction.
Oh, nice.
Oh,
yeah.
All right.
But the book is called Shards of Earth by Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Okay. And that is recommended by Andrew Dowd. Which means one thing, it is time for the audiobook of the week. And my pick this week is a good one. It is called The Book of Accidents by Chuck Wendig, narrated by G. Sands and George Newbern. So I know, Laura, you love Chuck Wendig's book, Wanderers, as I did as well.
Yeah.
This is a great one here. This is some epic, grand-in-scope horror involving forces of good and evil battling it out across a series of old haunted houses, haunted mines, and a boy who is a total empath and feels other people's pains to a severe extreme. In this book, we meet the Graves family, Nate, the father, Maddie, the mother, and their middle school-aged son, Oliver. So this family moves into the old rundown house in rural Pennsylvania, land of old coal mines that was once owned by Nate's no-good father. And his father left him this house in his will. Well, before you can say boo, strange events begin to happen to the Graves family. Oliver makes friends with a weird kid at school his parents really don't trust. Nate, the father, meets an interesting neighbor who happens to be a writer nearby. And slowly, Nate learns about the history of the town, none of which would make you want to pack up and head there to live. This is a book that slowly sinks its hooks into you as you get to know the characters and gradually picks up speed as the horror is unleashed until by the end, the action is at a breakneck pace. The story and the horror I found to be original and unique. And Wendy plays around with time and space as well as the supernatural. That's really, I don't want to give away too much that goes on in this book. But if you're a fan of horror that is kind of big in scope and kind of reminds me like a good old Stephen King novel, you'll enjoy this one. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is The Book of Accidents by Chuck Wendig.
Edmund Walker Reese was a man of numbers, not an accountant or a mathematician, but rather a man of simple interests. And it was here and now in the Blackledge SCI, State Correctional Institution, that he sat strapped to an electric chair, running the numbers. Three guards walked him here. They passed seven other prisoners on death row, each in his own cell. There would be one executioner, too. An anonymous man who would throw the switch, the man who would end Edmund Reese. It was 10 p.m. on a Tuesday, second Tuesday in March 1990. Time, after all, was a number, too. But there were details he did not yet know. And so he asked the older guard who was slitting Edmund's prison jumper up the calf to make room for the electrodes. The leg had already been shaved that morning right before Edmund Walker Reese, Eddie to his friends, of which he had none, ate his last meal, a simple bowl of wholesome chicken noodle soup.
Okay, there you go. That is our audiobook of the week, and that'll do it for us this week. Thank you so much to Jeffrey Deaver. Always great to talk to him. His new book is The Midnight Lock. Check it out. It's a good one. My name is Dave Medicus. See you next time.
Adios.
My number one elixir for anxiety, comfort food. Katie Lee.
Andrew Dowd.
Andrew Dowd. As he sets his, where did you put that container?
Well, anyway, he got up. Don't you remember? He tripped.
Oh, that's right. He did.
And we laughed.
In the kitchen.
See you next week.
My tight belt, it's open another notch.